Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. Scott Linden here. Glad you could join me. And soon we'll be taking a magical trip via technology to Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Yeah. We're going back to Pheasant Fest for a fascinating, informative interview with Pete Fisher of Dogtra. Yeah, the e-collar company. Pete is a former pro trainer, knows how to really use your e-collar to help your dog and make your life easier. Plus, a lot of practical dog training tips as well, so stand by for that from Pheasant Fest. We'll also take a road trip. Well, we'll make a road trip better by getting your dog to eat at the end of the hunt day. Yeah, a lot of us face that challenge. And then on the social media, I asked a question that turned out to be a great one for everybody. You will learn something about how to be a great hunting buddy. Yeah, the whys, wherefores, and hows to being a good guest. It's all coming up on the Upland Nation podcast, made possible by Sage and Breaker, Pointer Shotguns, Mid Valley Clays and Shooting School, TruLock Chokes, MidwayUSA.com, Purina, Pro Plan Sport Dog Food, LandTrust.com, ESP America, and High Viz Shooting Systems. Well, out on the back 40, we're planting birds in our launchers. We're not quite ready for that. I learned it again the hard way. But putting two birds in two launchers in the same spot. I remember the old days watching a video way back in the earliest days of YouTube of an old-time trainer who would plant one bird and then he'd dig a little hole and plant another bird right next to it. Yep. For the same reason. I'm trying to keep Flick steady. Through the first flush, through the second flush, and then to the fall of the bird, which is happening a little more frequently than I'd like it to, because some of those birds I'm planting I thought were pretty good flyers, but they're not. But it's working anyway. In fact, yesterday was really kind of funny. Put the birds out, flew the first one, perfect. Went away, was home in a moment or two from back there. Second one flew about 15 or 20 feet and landed so Flick could still see him. So I gave him the whoa command just in case. Walked over, kicked it up. It flew another 20 yards, of course, into another place that Flick could see. Popped a shot out of my starter pistol. Still steady. Directed his attention again through a dead bird in the other direction. Kept directing his attention because, as you can imagine, he was really keyed in on that live bird. Eventually, though, calmed him down, sent him for the dead bird. All is well in the world. Yeah, he's getting steady. Keep your fingers crossed. We still got a few months till the season starts. How about you? Well, I'm always stirring the pot, always asking questions that I think are of interest to you. That's why I do it. Yep. So on social media, I asked, what can a hunting buddy do to be a great hunting buddy? And I got a lot of great answers from you all. If you're interested in becoming one or searching for one, here are some bits of advice. Mike LaRoe says, bring proper refreshments for afterwards. Robert L. Brown says, train your dog to grab their birds and put them in your bag. Yeah, I get it. Yeah, very, very clever. And it's the only way I'm going to get any birds in my bag. Robert Osborne says, buy thousands of acres of hunting land. Everybody's a comedian. Barney Gray has a good one. What I try to do is show respect for my buddy's dogs. Always remember this. Your hunting buddy's dog means the world to him or her. Yeah, absolutely right. And as I've put it before, if your dog was better, we'd be hunting with him. Rob Warner says, take me to some good spots. Yeah, I get it. Wildfire Deacon says, push the cattails while I walk the edge for a change. Yeah, absolutely true. All true so far. Be fun to be with, says Gary Breismeister. Make every hunt enjoyable. Yeah, absolutely. Never shoot at low birds, says Lance Larson. Know where everyone is, including the dog, before shooting. Be on time. Don't cancel at the last minute, says Jay Knotner. If he doesn't have a dog, appreciate and compliment my dog. Have fun. Take turns on the birds. Leave the drama out. And split the gas costs, says John Kozlowski. Quit making it a competition, says Greg V. Finn. Make sure your dog knows obedience, says George Cummins. Yeah, I'd love, you know, we have never hunted together, George. Maybe I'll see you this year out there somewhere in the Midwest. I won't tell anybody where. Go long, keep your mouth shut, says Sandy Schwickerath. Shoot only the birds in front of you. Yeah, and a few more, some great ones out there, all having to do with being basically considerate, thoughtful, and not a whiner. Nobody likes a whiner. It takes some of us a long time to learn that, but it's absolutely true. Well, I learned something there. I hope you did too. It's all been brought to you by ProPlan Sport Dog Food. ProPlanSport.com is where you go for more information on ProPlan dog food, all the formulations, all the life stages. It's for active, hardworking dogs like sporting dogs. They're everyday elite athletes. Contain omega-3 fatty acid and glucosamine, help support joint health and mobility during training and throughout their life. I'm a believer. You will be too. Go to ProPlanSport.com. And see what you've been missing. Go to HighVizSites.com and learn all about all the things that make sense to me as a shooter. And I need all the help I can get. HighVizSites.com. They've got this patented interlocking light pipe system so you can quickly and easily switch out the colors of your light pipes. Now, the whole idea here is the relationship between your shotgun muzzle and the target. Yeah, don't obsess. Don't look at the shotgun muzzle, but know it's there with a little help from a high-vis sight. Easy to install. I just put another one of my side-by-sides. It's magnetic. You just snap it on. Change the color just as easily. Pull out one, put in the other light pipe. It helps your shooting in ways that your head consciously will never understand, but your subconscious will. Learn more at highvizsights.com. And I put that new sight on a pointer shotgun. You want to see all the choices, go to pointershotguns.com. I'm currently helping a friend find a youth gun, and guess where I started the search? Yeah, they've got youth guns, but they've also got those for young at heart individuals like you and me. Plenty of them, too. Semi-autos, over-and-unders, side-by-sides, all finishes from nickel to blued to case-colored to Cerakote in three different colors. Make PointerShotguns.com your first stop if you're upgrading. PointerShotguns.com. Well, technically it's day three of the Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic down here in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where it's kind of like a high school reunion where none of the Mead girls were there, you know, and I'm lucky enough to connect with all of my friends who I don't get to see more than once or twice a year, including Pete Fisher from Dogtra. Pete, welcome back to the Upland Nation podcast.
Thanks for having me. It's been a year.
Yeah, it's been a year. You're absolutely right, and and what a year it's been for all of us. We're going to talk about your products, maybe what's new there, but all sorts of other things. And everybody ought to know by now that Pete is over-experienced retriever trainer.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I found interesting, I just asked my my followers on my newsletter what they want to work on when it comes to dog training in the off season. And number two on the list, Pete, is retrieving. And now these are mainly upland hunters. So we're going to concentrate on that a little bit down the road. But first, let's talk about Dogtra and what's new in the way of dog training products over there.
Well, this particular year, Scott, we don't have anything that's brand new. We always have product in the pipeline that we're working on.
Yeah.
But I'll be honest with you, this year we've always had a lot of interest in, and I don't want to say we own this sector, but we come close to owning the training beeper collar sector, you know, where you can locate the dog in heavy cover, and we call it a T&B unit, so training and beeper unit.
Yeah.
But this particular year, I've seen more interest in GPS, tracking my dog. Now, I don't know if that means that dogs are more out of control, and they they need to be able to find them. So, you know, the old joke, you know, it's a true hunting dog because you have to go hunting for them. So, but I the reality is way more questions about GPS. How do I track my dog? Do you have a unit that will do that? And the answer is yes. We make a unit called Pathfinder, and it's the second version of it. The first one was Pathfinder 1, and the second one was Pathfinder 2. How's that for being innovative?
Well, it could be worse.
So, and I wouldn't doubt probably in the future it'll be Pathfinder 3.
Well,
so,
you know, it's a technology-based product, and so every time your cell phone is upgraded, you guys got to catch up to it.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to see that there's a 2 now, because the 1 was innovative in so many ways. Start with that. Let's start with the basics. The platform of the Pathfinder is different than a lot of people.
You are correct. It's biggest difference is it runs through your smartphone.
Yeah.
And so it's a app, and the next part that I always have to tell people, because it's the first question, is it a free app? And it is. And so the app is free. You can download it. You can play around with it and just experience what this unit will do, see the mapping capabilities of it without having to pay anything. But eventually, if you buy the product, you want to download the map and sync it to the unit. And what it does, Scott, is it gives you the ability to track your dog. And so what we do is we take the GPS, the coordinates, and overlay. The first version overlaid Google Maps. The second version now overlays something called Mapbox. But they're very realistic. Almost all of us know what Google Maps looks like. And so that is what it does, is it takes the coordinates, overlays on that map, and now you can see where you're at, where your dog's at, and where it's been, and track it. And besides that, you can also implement stimulation if you want. The latest version, the Pathfinder 2, the biggest change from the Pathfinder 1 to Pathfinder 2 is the fact that you can implement this stimulation off of what we call the connecting device. So you can do it. The first version, you could only do it off your phone.
Yeah.
The second version, you can do it off your phone and or off of the connecting device. So that's kind of it in a nutshell. And I think the other thing that I always have to mention when I talk about it is it's very affordable.
I think that's important to talk about.
Yes.
And then I want to talk about the technology a little bit. But go ahead.
Yeah, well, the reason it comes in at a price point that is very competitive is that you don't have to buy a handheld. Your handheld device is your phone. And so I would say the vast majority of this product's been sold from when it was initiated in the hound world, specifically the coon hunting world. But as I stated right off the bat, we're seeing more and more people in the upland world that want to have the ability to track their dog. And I think the other thing that has starting to come about is, and you know what this looks like because you upland hunt obviously extensively, is that you can be around big cornfields and standing corn, and dogs can get lost in it. So the unit is used really more as a safety device so that if I do lose my dog, I can turn it on, I can catch it, catch where the dog is going and get it before it goes to a road. So, you know, not only the ability to keep control of the dog, but also if by chance the dog gets lost, we can track it, because these units have a fairly substantial range. They're advertised at 9 miles on our big Pathfinder unit.
Sure.
But again, you know, that's always, there's going to be factors involved.
Hills.
Hills, terrain, things of that nature. Out where I'm at in rural Minnesota, I can get 5 to 6 miles out of mine easily.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I just wrote a piece for Gundog Magazine on first year puppy gear. What you should buy before you bring the puppy home. Mm-hmm. And I agonized over this for about a New York minute. And then I said, buy a GPS collar. Early on, not because you're going to use it to find him in the field, but you don't want to lose him. And mm-hmm. you just hit on that. And as an affordable insurance policy for lost dogs, I can't think of a better way.
Yeah, correct. And we make the unit in two versions, Pathfinder 1 and Pathfinder, and then the Pathfinder Mini. And so the Mini is a smaller version, has less range, but it's designed for, in the hound world, for beagles, let's say, Scott,
have
a physically smaller frame. But also in the pointing dog world, I mean, we've seen them walking by here. Look at how small some of the Brittany Spaniels are.
Yeah.
I went up and talked to an individual that has red setters up from our booth. By the way, Dogtra's booth 500. We better tell everybody that. I got to do a little self-promotion. Not that we need any more people coming by the booth.
And then virtually you go to Dogtra.com.
Yes.
Can't miss that.
Right, because there are so many other Dogtra Direct, Dogtra Store, Dogtra Warehouse, name it. That is not Dogtra.
Okay.
Those are dealers that have pilfered the Dogtra name, but the Dogtra.com is us. But back to what I was talking about, the size of the dogs, like these red setters I looked at.
Yeah.
You know, they're a small frame dog. The Brittany's a small frame dog. So the Pathfinder Mini is a good fit for those dogs.
Yeah. Now let's talk a little bit about the connections. You said connecting device.
Mm-hmm.
There is a process, and it starts with your phone. On one end is a smartphone.
Mm-hmm.
On the other end is the collar with the battery and the receiver transmitter.
Mm-hmm.
In between is what?
What I call the connecting device.
Yeah.
And the connecting device pulls all that information from the collar, from the sky, so to speak.
Yeah.
And we use GPS, and then we also use long-range radio signal called MERS band. And so that's why you see the antennas on the dog collar itself. But all that information, let's call it, gets synced up to your phone via a similar signal to Bluetooth, but it is not Bluetooth.
Yeah.
So the connecting device, Scott, has to be within about 20 feet of you all the time. It's not like you can take the connecting device and leave it in your house or vice versa. I just had a guy say this to me yesterday. Well, why, if I got the connecting device, why do I need the phone? I said, well, there's lots of reasons, but just take my word for it. You need it all to work.
Well, so, that's where the screen is, first of all.
Yeah, but if we're going to track,
So this is basically a little black box, and it hangs on your vest or in your pocket or something like that, right?
Correct. Has an antenna on it. Yeah, and we made ours bright yellow. So
thank you.
Yeah, you can find it when you drop it.
Isn't that the truth? Why don't more people do more of that sort of thing? But that's another story.
Yeah, we didn't make a camouflage.
No, I remember when I was doing a lot of consumer sports shows.
Mm-hmm.
And I got drafted to explain GPS because it had just come out.
Yep.
And how many camouflage handheld GPS units got lost out of a tree stand? I should have kept track.
Well, a story that I tell many times over when I was talking to Alex, the owner of Dogtra, and I told him the story about as we were starting to look into making a unit that was camouflage, a training collar. And I said, you have to realize that a camouflage unit is very similar to a good fishing lure. A good fishing lure is made to catch the fisherman, not necessarily the fish.
Yep.
So the same way with the camouflage unit, I said, you know, that's not going to get me any more ducks.
Yeah, absolutely.
And actually, if I drop it in the grass, it's going to make it harder to find. But so the units have been very popular, but at this event, I'm amazed to see how many people have stopped by and asked about it. We sold a substantial amount of them at the booth yesterday and Friday, and Friday was crazy busy here. I've never seen a Friday at Pheasant Fest, and I've worked a lot of them. I've never seen one that busy.
I think props to the folks in Sioux Falls, everybody from the Chamber of Commerce on down to the governor, actually.
Amazing.
Governor Noem as well. They pulled out the stops. They did it 4, 5, 6 years ago, did the same thing, showed everybody that there is room for a giant party for 25,000 pheasant hunters in a town like Sioux Falls.
Yes, and this facility is amazing. I look at last year in the Minneapolis area, and of course I'm from the Minnesota area, but I don't go to the Twin Cities all that often. But I just look at the buzz or the just everything that was going on here was just spectacular. One of the best pheasant fests I've ever been at, if not the best, Scott.
It's a vibe that you can't get anywhere but South Dakota.
Yeah,
you
know, a lot of good people.
There's a lot of bird. There's a lot of bird pheromone in the air in South Dakota.
Yes. Yep.
Pete Fisher with Dogtra. I'm Scott Linden. This is the Upland Nation podcast from Pheasant Fest in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And Pete's absolutely right on all of that. And we get a chance, you less than me, but I got the chance, especially on Friday, to roam around here and see all my good friends, make some new ones, and find some pretty interesting gear. It just based on what you've seen out here, maybe walking down to my booth, anything really interesting, unusual that people should know about?
Well, I really haven't had an opportunity to look around much. Yeah. This was the most just walking down to your booth to look around and run into a couple of people who I hadn't seen yet and visited with for just a minute. But I'm a gun nut, so I always like looking at shotguns. I'm a shotgun guy.
Yeah.
I'm always amazed at the shotguns that are out there. And here we are in your booth here with all these fabulous
some shotguns
guns.
Shotguns here in this pointer shotgun booth.
Amazing.
Yeah.
But there are... it seems like almost everybody, if you're anybody in the Upland world, you're here.
Yeah.
And so a lot of dog trainers, all of our competitors are at this with some kind of, all of the remote training collar companies are here in some form.
Yeah.
And so it's really fun to see it. But I really haven't looked around much, Scott.
You alluded, though, to shotguns, and what amazes me is in the last couple, 3 years, the number of new shotgun, fundamentally, they're importers.
Mm-hmm.
There are some great outfits out there, Upland Gun Company, who's basically bespoking guns at an affordable price, but there are a lot of new brands out there worth taking a look at, depending on where you are in your shotgun evolution. The other thing that I've noticed, and I'm a nut about this stuff, just wrote a piece on it, the number of people making strap vests these days.
Yeah.
If you don't have a strap vest in your line, dang, you're nothing anymore. And it's just mind-blowing to me to see how much of that is out there, and some pretty good ones.
Yeah.
So watch for that, by the way. That's coming up in Game and Fish magazine in August or September, a good rundown on all of that stuff.
It's amazing, Scott, the amount of quality travel kennels that are out there. And I still see vehicles going down the road with the dog, old six pack, just standing in the back, no crate. But the amount of crates, dog kennels, travel kennels on the market now are, and you name it. I mean, you got the years of the old plastic Very kennel are gone that we all started with.
Yep.
But there are a lot of really good quality dog crates. That's probably the couple things that caught my
good
eye as
point.
I walked down.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about collars in general. I've been intrigued with some of the things I've done in the last few years. With me, it seems like every bird species has gotten a little bit more crafty, a little bit more wily, a little bit more paranoid. So I'm learning to shut the heck up and be a little bit more stealthy out in the field. So I'm using my whistle yet less. I'm using my voice less to work with a dog. I'm using my arms and hands more. And I'm using my collars in different ways. Have you thought about that? Have you talked to people? Do you do it yourself when you were a trainer?
Yes. So with our Dogtra products, we have what we call a non-stimulating attention getter.
Yeah.
So it doesn't, when you push this button, it vibrates. We call it pager, but it's very similar to the pager you have in your phone, on your phone, and you've got it in your pocket. And we do offer tone, which is a high-pitched tone.
Yeah.
For the dog to hear, not for you to hear. We do make a beeper unit for you to locate your dog in the cover, but some products have tone. But what I always tell people, you know, this room is very loud. And so if I have my phone in my pocket and I get a call, I may not hear it ringing. But when I feel the vibration against my, in my pocket, I'll acknowledge it. And the dogs are the same way. So we have a pager option on it. You can use it for a, what I might call a silent recall, dogs getting too far out of gun range, and I vibrate them a little bit, reel them back in. I had somebody, a number of people stop by yesterday looking at our beeper units, and the beeper unit is made so that I can hear the dog and locate where it's at. And so I like to use the locate only mode. And what this individual said was, you know, what I've noticed is the dog started responding to the locate by starting to come back in and reel in its distance from me. And I said, well, yeah, that makes sense, because after you've beeped it a number of times to see where it's at, meaning you can't see it or hear it, don't know where it's at, and you've beeped it a number of times, what you've probably done is probably put some stimulation to the dog, okay? And what's happened is the dog, over the course of time, has started to figure out, if he hears the beeping, I better come back in some, because the next step is going to be some stimulation to get his attention.
You know, it's funny, that seems to be the default behavior of many dogs, and as a trainer, you might have seen that. A lot of dogs get either scared, confused, inquisitive, when they get a little nick, and the first thing they want to do is come back to a known factor. That's they're human. Yep. Have you seen that in a lot of dogs?
Well, you see it when the dog hasn't been conditioned to the stimulation properly.
Yeah.
And I wish I had a nickel for every time I've said this. The remote training collars use the reinforced commands the dog already knows.
Yeah.
So there's a 3-step process. I was visiting with a guy yesterday that's actually in the one of our competitors, and Clay and I were talking about remote training collars and how they're used and how they aren't being used. And I said, you know what? It's a 3-step process, what I tell people. That dog's got to know 3 things. Come to me, go stationary, go away from me.
Yeah.
Once he knows that, then I can use a remote training collar to reinforce it. But I still reinforce it in the early stages with the dog on a rope or leash. That's our safety net. That's how we guide the dog. Because the dog does not know what to do when he feels that, as my old, dog training friend Robin McFarland would say, the dog doesn't know what to do when it feels that sensation.
Yeah.
And so we have to teach the dog what we want. And that way, when eventually our goal is to get the dog to the point where we no longer have the rope or the leash on it, but we have some distance out there and we have some control.
Yeah.
We can reinforce a sit command, a standing stay, a whoa position, or a recall.
Yeah.
And what happens with a lot of these remote training collars is the first thing, and really it's the key command, is recall.
Yeah.
A dog that doesn't recall consistently is typically a dog that's going to be in trouble. So it's our first command, but if you don't go through all the proper steps that I just explained, come to me, go stationary, go away from me, then all you got is come to me. And so anytime the dog feels the stimulation, he's going to come to me, just like you explained early on.
You know, I buy into that completely, and I advocate for it in many ways. And we talk about how to transition to an e-collar, and we talk about, you train the dog in a yard, you have a check cord, you use treats if you need, whatever it is, and then you overlay the collar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's, for most people, that's as far as it goes. So let's use the recall command, and just let's get to the nexus where the rubber meets the road.
Right.
Dog's on a check cord. He's 24 feet away. He's got the e-collar on. He knows that when you say here, he's supposed to come your way.
Mm-hmm.
You've worked on that with the leash. You've worked on that with food treats or whatever you need. And now it's time to start adding the stimulation. So he's out there and he doesn't want to come when you call. So you could yank him in. You could reel him in with that cord.
Yes.
And you've done that a dozen times, or 10 dozen times. Mm-hmm. He's supposed to know. Mm-hmm. When do you use the e-collar stimulation?
The way I use it, when I start reinforcing that command, the dog is on the rope or the leash.
Yeah.
I give the verbal cue to come to me. I use here. As I give that command, I start applying light stimulation. Nick, nick, nick.
Yeah.
As soon as the dog, this is the way I do it now, okay? As the dog commits to the command, the stimulation stops.
Uh-huh.
He finishes the command and we positive reinforce. Now, there are some trainers, not saying this is right or wrong, they start the stimulation, do not stop the stimulation until the dog completes the command. And, you know, it's that old classic line, Scott. You can put 3 dog trainers in a room, and you know the only thing 2 of them are going to agree on is the third one's wrong. So there's many different ways to skin that cat, as you know.
Yep.
I'm just telling you what I've used, and I'd like to think I've had a little bit of success with it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying the other ways of doing it are wrong. I'm just telling you how I do it.
Well, if you and I are in sync on this one. Mm-hmm. That's Pete Fisher with DogPer, by the way. I'm Scott Linden. And that is, if they're making any effort to comply for a while, I'm good with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then that while stretches as they mature and as the commands become more familiar. So thanks. That's
correct.
That's great. I appreciate your taking me to school on that.
Yes.
And that's a good place to stop. We will be talking about retrieving for the uplands a lot, because I know that's of real interest to everybody there. That'll be up in just a moment after these brief messages. We'll talk about how to feed the right way after a hunt, and more with Pete Fisher coming up after a word from LandTrust.com. Get outdoors without the crowds. Discover and book exclusive access on private lands for you and your dog, you and a guest and a dog, or just you. Private land access takes the stress out of planning. You always know where you're going to be, and you'll know it's going to be open to you, so you can focus on what you want to focus on, having a good time with your dog in incredible places. Sign up for a free account and shop around, whether it's Montana for sharp tails, South Dakota for ringnecks, you name it, they've got it, and a lot of stuff that may not be available in some of those other states. Learn more at LandTrust.com. LandTrust.com. And shoot better the easy way. Yeah, one of my tricks. A better pattern means more birds in the bag, and you get a better pattern from a TruLock choke. TruLock, TruLockChokes.com. They make their choke tubes from 17-4 stainless steel bar stock. It resists rust and corrosion. The choke tubes are heat treated, so they're stronger and resist wear and choke creep. There's always a lifetime warranty and a satisfaction guarantee, plus plenty of incentives to save you money. Learn more at TruLockChokes.com. Welcome back to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm here on the floor of the Sioux Falls, South Dakota Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic with Pete Fisher of DogTra. We're in the Pointer Shotguns booth, and boy, oh boy, if you get a chance to look at them, I've had some really interesting reactions to some of these guns, whether it's affordability, fit and finish, all of those things. Just go to pointershotguns.com. And thank you, Chad, and everybody here at the booth have been so kind to let me in here and get in the way. Pete, we were talking before the break about using the collar, and I want to get back to that. I want to also, if I say it, maybe I'll remember to talk about it, verbal commands. Your vocabulary, I'll bet, differs from mine. But before we get into that, the biggest issue when it comes to off-season training this year among my followers seems to be getting an upland dog to retrieve. And I heard some great stories yesterday, and people, hey, I'm not judging anybody out there. Finished dog to you is a finished dog to you, and that's great. More power to you. Many of us want our dog to bring the bird all the way back. Some dogs will stand on the other side of that slough and at least tell you where it is so you get to wade through and pick it up. But most of us would rather the dog brought it back. Can you offer up, and granted, again, these are for upland dogs, mm-hmm. maybe not the high test retrievers that you field trial or you hunt test or that you as a trainer for 30 years were training. What can you offer in the way of advice, either starting the training, finishing the training, reinforcing? What do you find helpful to us?
Sure. Well, first and foremost, I like to have a dog that has some natural desire to go and chase after something, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and even in the retriever world, And I'm a Labrador Retriever guy. Retrieve meaning go get something and bring it back to me. I tell people all the time, the natural instinct of this dog is not necessarily to bring it back to me.
Yeah.
It's the natural instinct, if we left him in their natural state before we domesticated this dog, when it was a dingle, it'll run out and got that bird and chewed it up and ate it, or
yeah,
taken it and buried it to
yeah,
eat it later.
Yep.
So my goal as a trainer is to get a dog that likes to go chase after that bird,
yeah, yeah,
and bring it back to me for my table. So with that said, and with that theory, that applies to all breeds. Now, when you get into some of the pointing breeds, you're not going to have that same great desire to retrieve that a high-end field trial Labrador Retriever would have. But guess what? I find some Labrador Retrievers that don't have a lot of desire to retrieve either.
Sure.
So, you know, it's just the nature of the beast. Some,
yeah,
they're all different, just like people.
Can I, you know, I'm with you 110%, Pete, because I also believe that's a good way to teach some other things,
mm-hmm,
as well. But that prey drive, birdiness, if you will, in the broadest sense of the term, mm-hmm, is really useful in that regard, isn't it?
Well, it is. And you know, that we can touch on something called the force retriever, force fetch.
Yeah.
But if you're what I always called force fetching from scratch on a dog that had no desire to retrieve anything, well, you, as my old football coach Pete Hurd said, you got a long row to hoe,
yeah,
because you're trying to push square peg in a round hole. It's much easier if I have a dog that has some desire to retrieve. So I want to first bring out that desire to retrieve with the dog. And one of the things that I see, regardless again of the breed, is that people have this tendency to throw the tennis ball for the dog, which is great as a puppy, and put it on a long rope, put it down a hallway so the dog can't get away from you, try and develop a natural retrieve. But what happens with a lot of people is it's so much fun to throw the tennis ball, they think that, well, if 5 times is good, well, then 10's better, and of course 50's even better. And consequently, puppies are like children. They have a very short attention span. And so at about maybe number, the key is to stop when they still want more. And we,
yeah,
all know that, but
yeah,
that is the tricky part of it. And people say to me, well, once he just quits, the dog just quit retrieving. And I said, well, how many did you throw? Well, 20. I said, well, it sounds like you should have stopped at 19. But that's the part of reading your dog and stopping when they still want more, when they're in that puppy phase.
Yeah.
Because we will build on that, as you said earlier. We're going to build this dog. I just got a very good compliment on one of my dogs, Rush, who a year ago when I did this podcast with you, he was in Alabama with a trainer because we just can't do much competitive training up here in the Midwest.
Yeah. Yeah.
And eventually Rush became a master hunter by the age of about 2.5, even before that. But the trainer, Richard Meisman, who's a friend of mine, called me one day and we were talking, and so I had done almost all the training on this dog before Richard had his hands on him, and he said, Pete, you built a hell of a dog here.
Yeah.
So that's the best compliment I can give anybody, or the best compliment a trainer can get, is that we're building this dog and hey, you've built a hell of a dog at this point. So it is a building block process. So with the retrieve, we want to start out and encourage that desire. We want to make it fun. You know, people will have a dog in the house and picks up a shoe and runs around with it, and they grab the shoe and they belt them over the head with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, just think about it. Just
yeah,
think what you've done wrong there. And then they say, well, you know, he just seems shy to go get anything. Wonder
gee,
why.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I used to talk about it a lot more on the show than I do now, this show and then the TV show both. But if you just think about what you're doing to mm-hmm. a dog, or not doing to a dog, if you just watch a dog,
mm-hmm.
You will learn a lot more about dogs. But we, and in the field, it's particularly important because we're out there and we're talking about last night's football game.
Mm-hmm.
We're admiring the view. We're maybe showing off our new gun. And all of a sudden, the dog is doing things that we should have helped him do or stopped him from doing. But we're not even paying attention. I got a shout out to George Quinlan. George was the first great trainer / behaviorist I worked with who, to echo your 19 retrieve rendition,
mm-hmm.
he called me a greedy owner because I was like that guy. I would throw that bumper until the dog said, to heck with this. And I found I was doing it, number one, to show off to myself, but also to show off to everybody else who might be laying around watching me while I was working. And it's a great way to think about it. You know, any more these days, with especially with wire hairs for me, but for anybody with maybe an upland breed, a few is plenty, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we just want to bring out that natural ability. We want to make it positive. We don't want to overdo it. Because what happens is it's when you overdo it and the dog loses the interest to go out and chase that bumper, the ball, whatever it may be, now the subsequent sessions, always try and end on a positive note.
Yeah.
And so end on a positive note when the dog goes out and gets the tennis ball, brings it back. We're talking about a little puppy.
Yeah.
You know, and just make everything fun. So people forget that. They have these aspirations of what they want this dog to be. But it goes back to what I said about 5 minutes ago. Don't forget, we're attempting to build a hell of a dog here.
Yeah.
And it isn't all, as my mom used to say, Rome wasn't built in a day.
No.
And it's the same way with a quality dog, but you got to lay that foundation down first.
Let's make the transition from getting a dog to come back to us with something in its mouth. Where do birds or bird parts fit into all of that, especially vis-a-vis the e-collar?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a million bits of advice from so-called experts about never use stimulation when the dog is around a bird. Certainly not when he's pointing a bird, but maybe not when he's got a bird. How do you feel about that, and how do we make that transition?
Well, first I start with, I'm never going to give that puppy or a young dog a live bird to start with.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
Because it's just so many things can go wrong. So
I
start with a dead frozen bird, a bumper with pheasant wings, duck wings attached to it, and we progress up to a dead bird and then a shot bird and so on, just depending on what I'm doing with that dog. But to tie the remote training collar in with any of the retrieving, you have to be so careful. And here's what I mean by that. The dog is now out at a distance, beyond distance of that to have a rope on him.
Yeah.
So I need some kind of control. And the dog runs out and it gets that first training bird. And by the way, all this is done in training. I'm not doing this out on the first day of pheasant season. Okay?
But for those of you who are thinking about that, please do not train your dog in the field.
Yeah.
I had to rescue a wire hair after that once.
Well, I was doing some dog demonstrations for Youth Pheasants Forever group up in our neck of the woods for Stearns County Pheasants Forever. So I got to give those guys a shout out because I was part of that group for many years and a 40-year sponsor of it yet. But I was doing a youth dog demonstration for a youth day. Had about 50 or 100 kids there. And I always try and explain and hopefully that they understand on a level that a kid and a parent can understand. And the story I always tell is, you know, before we take a dog in the field, we need to practice.
Yeah.
Okay? We don't.
Yeah.
Then I say, how many of you play youth baseball? And little Johnny or Sally raises their hand, and I say to them, you went and practiced before you went and played a game. And if we don't do that, little Johnny gets up to bat, and lo and behold, he gets his first hit. He's never been in practice. He hits the ball. He doesn't know to run to first base, third base, back to the dugout or the parking lot, Scott. So the same with the dog. We have to lay a foundation. We have to practice in the yard. In the professional training world, we call that yard training.
Yeah.
It's not out in the field. It's the yard where we're building all of this foundation so that when we take that dog out in the field and Scott and Pete are hunting together and Scott looks over and says, Pete, you built a hell of a dog. All of that is done in the yard long before we take them out in the field. So with a remote training collar, one of the things I see is that the dog gets out a distance now, and with that distance becomes a distraction because you're not right near it. There's no rope on it. And a lot of people think, well, this is my opportunity to use the training collar and teach him to bring that back. And that's not where we do that. We just don't.
So go back to the yard, by the way, and you'll never say to me, I've built a hell of a dog, because it ain't going to happen. But your analogy about baseball just reminds me, even at the somewhat higher levels,
mm-hmm.
I was watching a minor league game. No, it was a spring training game, but all the guys who will end up in Double A and Single A and Triple A were were on the roster that day, and thinking the same thing. This is when you're in the big yard training your dog. So let's go back to that, and we got a dead bird, or bird pieces probably, and we're trying to put the finishing touches in the yard on that retrieve. Where do we mix check cord or no check cord birds, real bird parts, and the e-collar?
Well, I'm going to the dog's going to be on the leash, the rope, whatever you want to call it, early on.
Yeah.
And when I feel comfortable that he's doing all the things I want, he's carrying the bird nice, I've taught him the hold command, he will walk at my side, he'll go in a stay position, recall to me with the bird, bumper with wings, whatever in his mouth, jump up on a crate, lots of positive reinforcement involved. Now we're ready to maybe start moving off of the rope or leash and working on off-leash training with the bird in its mouth.
Yeah.
And some people, and I trained a lot of dogs that I force-fetched them.
Yeah.
And force-retrieve, which means I use the ear pinch method.
Yeah.
You put light pressure on the dog's ear. It's uncomfortable. The dog learns. It's a form of what we call escape training. It escapes the pressure on the ear by putting the bumper in the mouth. But first, I've taught him the hold command.
Yes.
To do it the other way is, you know what, backwards. And so to try and get that dog to force after a bird or a bumper when you haven't taught the hold command first, sure, I can get him to force to it, but guess what he's going to do? Spit it out.
Right.
So we teach the hold command first. Then we will put some light pressure on the ear and teach force, then go to the ground with force. If you're really good with a remote training collar, we use light stimulation to teach the dog to pick it up off the ground. So it's a process, again. It just doesn't all happen overnight. And a lot of people say to me, well, how long is it going to take you to force fetch my dog?
Forever.
Yes. and that is a good response. But most people want some kind of a end date where they're going to when the dog's going to be done. But as you well know, every dog is different.
Yeah, there's always room for summer camps.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Brush up.
But you know, you just hit on something that a lot of people, I don't believe, think about, and I sure didn't. And that is, the hold command is a separate command, and it's critical to the whole process. Mm-hmm. And now I understand why it's critical before you start employing the remote training collar, because that command has been mastered. So the next command is chained into the mastered command, and so there's no direct correlation. There's no direct link. Pardon the pun. Between the hold command and what might result in a train wreck when you hit the red button on the collar.
Right. And, you know, the important part of that is the better we do that basics, the foundation work of leash training, the easier our transition will be to the remote training collar.
Yeah.
I can take a remote training collar and put it on a dog that has had virtually no training whatsoever, and it might be a runner, is what we call it, a dog that just takes off and is gone, if it's not in a kennel or on a rope or a leash. And in a fairly short period of time, I can get results with a remote training collar, teaching that dog to recall, just with light stimulation, positive reinforcement when it complies with the commands. That's one thing, okay? And just a very, very basic thing. But we want to put all of those three steps together so that we have a dog that's got a hell of a foundation with us. And then we can, you know, if I can't get the dog to sit at my side when I've got no distractions, how am I going to get the dog to sit at 150 yards and take a cast for me in the retriever world? So it's all done in little segments.
Yeah.
But you have to realize that the obedience part of it is so important that we just don't start with a remote training collar. We have to have all the obedience down first.
Yeah. You know, you said several things that reminded me of a lesson I learned from Bob Ferris. He's a great poodle pointer, breeder, and trainer in Boise. The point and the retrieve, they struck me as your philosophy is identical to Bob's in that regard. He uses it in the point. You use it in the retrieve. Dogs will do certain things instinctively. They'll point a bird. They'll run out and try and eat a bird. That is when we transition from pointing or running out, the first half of the retrieve, to the obedience end of the same act. once they're on point, once they're running out, then they have to be trained extensively to do the other half, whatever it is. In pointing, we know what that is. In retrieving, we know what that is. But it's a melding of instinct and obedience.
Correct.
Yeah.
And, you know, and if we can identify, you know, if you can kind of think like a dog,
yeah,
that helps a lot. And so many times, even myself, working with a young dog that I have of my own, and the dog's name is Reed, and he's a talented dog, but at times my grandson Josh is out with me, and I have to watch what I say, but Reed has become known as Reed is a knucklehead. And so we have to think about what we're doing with this dog. I was doing some casting drills with him the other day. It's been very nice in Minnesota, by the way. We've been able to train
here. It's spring-like.
No water to be had. You know, everything's frozen, but everything's open. And I was doing some casting drills with him, and he got a little confused, and I was just standing there watching him. And, you know, and this goes back to what I was mentioning earlier. You got to think about what is the dog thinking at that point. And a lot of people may have looked at it, and if you're going to lose your temper, you look at it, well, that son of a gun is doing this on purpose. Dogs don't do that. Dogs do, believe me, dogs do not.
Okay,
they don't have
you.
The ability to.
Yeah.
They do not have the ability to be looking at Scott or Pete and saying, you know, I'm going to really stick it to him today. No, they just don't. They act and react based on the environment, okay? And so he was confused. He wanted to cast back on an angle back right. I wanted him to go left. He kept going back right, even on the left. He was defying me. And so what did I do? He was at about 30 yards. I just walked forward. I shortened the space, made it more of a teaching opportunity, and cast him. And guess what? He eventually went and did it. I came back, did it again, and reinforced. And then guess what I did? I ended.
Yeah.
End
right
on that note. Yes.
Yeah, always on a high note. And, you know, it's funny. I wrote about this, well, in my first book, actually, that sometimes the only difference between compliance and disobedience is how far away you are from that dog.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if he's doing the math and thinking, maybe he could catch me if I flipped him off.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's more than that. I think maybe it's they can see the whites of your eyes or something. But I'm glad to hear a pro who uses that same strategy or trick or whatever we want to call
because
it.
Because we sometimes, all of us, lose our temper. Some of us all, you know, we've had whatever may trigger us to be thinking that way, that Reed, that knucklehead, is sticking it to Pete. And it always reminds me of another story. My son, Nate, my oldest son, Nate, officiates a lot of high school basketball. And, of course, they get a lot of hard timing from the fans, from the players, from the coaches. And, you know, it's you know, you're siding with this team. You know, it's a homer call. And my son, Nate, said this to me one day. He said, three officials, he said, were getting ready to go out on the court. He said, guess what, Dad? We don't care who wins the game. He said, we have no dog in this fight. We just want to make sure we don't have many errors, that we call a good game. But for fans or a coach to be sitting in the stand saying the officials are going to stick it to us or they're doing it on purpose, Nate was like, we could care less. The same way with the dog. The dog is not sitting there looking at Scott and Pete saying, yeah, today I'm going to stick it to him, just make his day rough. They just act and react based on what we're doing. And so the training situation that we set them up with, many times even I forget this, Scott. I forget that I do my best to set them up for success. And because too many times when we set them up and they fail, that's when the wheels come off everything.
Yeah. Now, I bet your son would agree that if we could only put an e-collar on everybody in the stands at a basketball game, it would be a much more civilized game.
Pete Fisher could not do his job because, you know what? Pete Fisher would throw half of the fans out of the building.
Exactly.
So, Nate's pretty thick-skinned.
Well, good.
Yeah,
you got to be. Believe me.
Oh, gosh, yes.
I've done a little bit of that.
Thankless job.
You can have it. Yeah.
Thankless job.
But speaking of that, thankful job, mine, interviewing you. Pete Fisher with Dogtra. Dogtra.com is where you learn more about their Pathfinder, Pathfinder 2, all the new whiz-bang additions, improvements, and all of that. I'm Scott Linden. This is Upland Nation podcast from the Sioux Falls, South Dakota, Pheasant Fest and Quail Classic. Pete, thanks again for being a part of the Upland Nation podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'll come on anytime you want.
Great. Strategic feeding for your dog. Coming up soon on the Upland Nation podcast. First, a message from MidwayUSA.com. You know, no matter what I need, no matter what time of year it is, my first stop is MidwayUSA.com. Whether it's camping gear, fly fishing stuff, regular plain old fishing stuff, and of course, all the things we need as bird hunters and dog owners. It's all there. Sign up for their emails or text notifications. You'll get 10% off your next order. Fill up the shopping cart, then check out and save yourself a good solid 10%. Yeah, everything from youth shotguns to fishing flies, customer satisfaction and engagement is their number one goal. Yeah, still owned and run by the founder, Larry Potterfield, who goes to work every day with one goal, take care of you and me. That's MidwayUSA.com. And take care of your gun as well at SageAndBreaker.com. Their products are crafted at the highest caliber, lifetime warranty on virtually everything, except the consumables. You're not going to keep them a lifetime or you're not taking good care of your gun. So if you're looking for something to clean your gun with, they've got it. If you're looking for something to store or carry your gun, they've got it. From scoped rifle cases to shotgun bags to cleaning mats, and then all the consumables. Firearms grease, clean lube and protect spray. It's all right there at sageandbreaker.com. Don't miss out on future sales, including the upcoming Father's Day sale. Sign up for their mailing list at sageandbreaker.com. Well, this week on the road trip, something that's, well, universally needed, and that is food for your dog every night after a hunt. And if you're like me and a lot of other folks, including all the pro trainers I've worked with, first off, it's critical that that dog get enough calories into him or her at the end of the day, because most of us aren't feeding at the beginning of the day. I'm not going to go into that one. That's a topic for another discussion. So for feeding once a day, it's critical that we get a lot of calories into that dog. Here's mine, formulated from all the times I've marshaled, gunned, hunted with, or done anything with pro trainers and pro guides. Take it for what it's worth. The first thing I do at the end of the day is not feed. I need to get some maltodextrin into my dog. Maltodextrin turns into glucose, which turns into glycogen, and that's how you rebuild the cell walls overnight. So to do that, I mix something like GlycoCharge or even some of the weightlifters straight ahead maltodextrin into water. If Flick won't eat that, there are plenty of ways to bait it with, you know, beef stock or something else. I like Purina's Fortiflora. It's just a little, it's a probiotic, but it must smell or taste really good. Sprinkle it on the water. He'll gobble it right up, so to speak. He'll lap it right up. 90 minutes later, after that maltodextrin has turned into glycogen and is working its way through the muscle cells, then I feed. I don't do it earlier, and here's why. The fat in a dog food will inhibit the uptake of the maltodextrin. That's why you want to be careful about what you bait the water with as well. I always feed a high-quality food, as you can imagine, balanced and complete. And then if he still turns up his nose at it, I'll add something. Now, in the old days, they'd put wet cat food, under the kibble. Now I've gone away from cat food because the formulations aren't good for a dog. They're not as good for a dog. But I'll use those little dog canisters of wet food. That'll always get them going. Sometimes I'll even add more Fortiflora on the top. Again, I don't have the nerve to taste it, and as you probably remember, Carl Gunzer's never tasted it either, and he works for Purina. But the dogs love it, and if you can't get your dog to feed with Fortiflora on top, well, try that little dog food, small can of wet food and see what happens. You can always add gravy or meat stock. Be careful of the salt content in a lot of those. And then towards the end of the evening, if you can get your dog to eat just a little bit more, all the better. Because remember, in the morning, probably not going to feed them. You want to keep that GI tract clear. It won't process in time to do them any good that day anyway. So the idea of a, you know, carbohydrate load or anything else isn't going to help your dog the next day. Feed quality food the night before. Use all the tricks. If you got a few more of those, I'd love to hear about them. Always looking for help in that regard. Good luck. Have a great trip wherever you're going. And the road trip segment this week was brought to you by ESPAmerica.com. You know, I've been there and done that. I'm tired of trying to remember to put plugs in before every shot in the field, or they just don't feel right, or they're weird. You can't hear as much as well, or all the things you want to hear. Not true with ESPAmerica.com. They've been making electronic hearing protection since 1994. It's custom fit. You can barely tell you got them in. They sound great. Minimal wind noise thanks to their design and their patented software. Learn more about why you should and why you should go to ESPAmerica.com for that electronic hearing protection at ESPAmerica.com. Of course, every time I take a lesson at Mid-Valley Clays and Shooting School, I'm putting in my electronic hearing protection. Don't have to do that when I'm shopping for a shotgun, though, because Dave Fiedler has my 6. Yeah, they're sub-gauge central, 20s, 28s, 410s, always in stock, and Dave will be glad to counsel with you on what you might need most in that regard. You know, whether it's left-handed shooting, cross dominance like me, tall, short, something in between. He knows everything about how guns are designed, which ones might fit you the best, which ones might perform the best for you. If you're shopping for a gun, start at midvalleyclays.com. Call Dave. He's glad to help. And then, remember, when you're ready to buy, he can ship anywhere, anytime. midvalleyclays.com. Well, thanks to everybody who listens so intently. I sure appreciate your help on those social media posts. If you left a rating or a review, thank you so much. Thanks to Pete Fisher for being a great guest, as always. And thank you to our sponsors, Sage and Breaker, Purina Pro Plan Sport, ESP America, Mid-Valley Clays, True Luck Chokes, MidwayUSA.com, LandTrust.com, Pointer Shotguns, and Hi-Viz Shooting Systems. Sure enjoy sharing this stuff with you. Hope you learned something. I know I did. Until I see you next time, maybe we'll meet at the range. I'm Scott Linden. Thanks for listening to the Upland Nation Podcast.